Meditations with Ryan Slomak.
Greetings and welcome to episode 17 of Meditations. I'm your host, Ryan Slomak, and this is a show dedicated to making space for conversation to see what we can learn from one another. If we're willing to ask the right questions and just absorb the information that other people give us, we oftentimes can find ways to reach the next rung of our own intellectual capacity, or at the very least, learn some fun facts along the way. On today's episode, we have Julie Sellers, who is the CEO of Elevated Outcomes, which is a creative consulting agency based in Tennessee. We're going to talk about a lot of different things, but we're going to talk about marketing. We're going to talk about niche skill sets. We're going to talk about what it's like to work abroad versus what it's like to work domestically, the way in which you can take skills you've developed in other businesses and apply them. In her case, she worked in insurance for a very long time and then transitioned that to working with entrepreneurs. And we're going to talk about the sort of perks and challenges of owning your own business or your own firm. So if you're interested in learning about all things creative consulting, you're in the right place. So without further ado, here is Julie Sellers. All right. So Julie, thanks so much for being on the show. What you're not just in Nashville, you're in East Nashville. Tell me what excitement is happening in East Nashville at this juncture.
Oh, thank you for pointing that out. I appreciate that specificity. At East Nashville, people are very proud of East Nashville. I mean, the exciting thing happening right now is it's wintertime for us right now, and we just had a tremendous snowfall, which I say tremendous relative to Nashville. So that's the exciting thing happening in Nashville. And then I would say in East Nashville specifically, I'll build on that. You know, it's a little kind of like wackier, edgier part of town. So this was actually something I learned this week. Apparently there is a snow chicken that comes out when it snows here every couple of years. And so some of my friends were sending around pictures of the chicken in Shelby Park that was sledding with kiddos as the snow came out. So if you know anything about Nashville, that kind of tells you everything about East Nashville specifically.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm never going to be able to respect a groundhog in the way that I would respect a snow chicken.
That's right. Exactly.
All right. Add that to my 2024 goals is go sledding with a chicken.
That's right.
Awesome. So Julie, one of the reasons I was really just excited to have you on the show is because you've had a really interesting a career where you started in the sort of like finance, or sorry, the insurance industry, right? And then sort of made your out. But the other thing that you've done is that you also have a really interesting educational background. And as I was researching, you went to St. Joseph's University and got a BS in food marketing.
I did. This is the second time this has come up this week, actually, after not talking about it for years and years.
That is just such an interesting, just niche approach to a marketing degree. I'm like really curious what sort of drew you to studying that when you were so young.
Oh my gosh, this is going to be really embarrassing to admit this out loud. So St. Joseph's, like, it's a very renowned program. Like, if you are interested in the business of food, that is one of the places in the country that you want to go. Like, it's a very esteemed program. So I started out with a major just in generalized marketing. And then here's the embarrassing part. The thing that, I mean, I love food, but the thing that tipped me into like then really honing in and specializing in food marketing was junior year, at the time I was there at least, junior year, the food marketing majors went on a trip to Chicago. And that was appealing to me as a 19 or 20 year old or whatever it was. And I mean, look, I had some friends in the major and they were like super high on it and talking me into it. And then this trip was like, well, that would be fun. And I ended up for a general marketing class. I had a professor he taught this marketing class, but he was kind of one of the ambassadors for the food marketing department. And so I did have a serious conversation with him about it. And basically I said to him, you know, I'm nervous about being pigeonholed though. Like, what if I don't want to go into food? And he had said to me, Dr. Herbst, I think he's at William & Mary now. He had said to me, you know, like, here's the thing. And maybe this was kind of my first real marketing lesson. He was like, you always want to niche down and you can go broader, but it's actually like a really smart, keen place to start from, like super, super specificity, and then you can extrapolate it to larger things. So he really made an argument for like, if you do want to go into food, this will certainly set you apart, but it's not going to limit your opportunities. So then I did switch over to food marketing. I minored in French as well. And then kind of the interesting thing that happened after that was, I guess I did go on this trip junior year. The year after junior year, the summer, I nannied for a summer in France. And it was while I was in France that I feel like I really learned about like good food for the first time. And this was many years ago before there were kind of all these holistic food movements, et cetera. And it was actually in France, I kind of decided like, I actually don't think I want to work in the food industry because at the time it was so consumer packaged goods focused. So that was kind of like a major like world and life shift for me and kind of how I viewed world and ultimately I think how my career would go.
I remember having, I very vividly remember being in ninth grade, my earth science teacher saying, you know, like everyone comes to my class and they say, when am I going to use earth science? He's like, you want to know a secret, kids? He's like, you have no idea what you're going to do with your careers. And I, you know, like me personally, like I have an MFA in documentary filmmaking, but I teach in a computer science department at a university. Like,
right.
You never know how you're going to find these things. But I think that advice about like really niche, you can niche down is a really great point though, because the amount of people that I know that have general knowledge. And then when you're competing in the marketplace, you're competing with these people who have very specific experiences. It's hard to sit there and tell someone like, no, I'll learn it when the institutional knowledge is already there.
Right. And I would also say too, like, I mean, this is something we kind of like coach our team internally and then like clients on too, like the riches are in the niches, right? Like specificity creates the hooks that not only attracts people from a marketing point of view, but what you're saying, like a talent point of view, et cetera, like people attach to specificity as opposed to like kind of big general theoretical things. So I like that comparison and I totally agree with you.
That's awesome. So after that, you ended up joining the insurance industry, right? You worked for mm-hmm. AIG in New York City, AVP in Boston. What made you gravitate to that industry?
So, I mean, a couple of things, and I feel like this is so counter to most people. I really, really, really wanted to work for a big corporation. Like I did. I loved the idea of the structure. I loved the idea of kind of like the power of an organization like that. And then you and I were talking about this a little bit before we hopped on. I mean, from a very young age, and we can go however far or not into this as you want, like, especially as a female, I think having control, having my own money and control and understanding of my own money has been something important to me since like literally elementary school. And so, you know, insurance is a financial services market. So it's not like finance, but it's in that world. It's understanding numbers. I had an aunt who worked for AIG. So she was the one who very generously gave me the introduction kind of segue in. So I want to give, you know, credit to that connection. But I wanted businessy business experience. I was excited about like, to me, the sexiness of kind of numbers and really understanding that, et cetera. And then, you know, the specific field of insurance I went into was high net worth personal insurance. So there also was some sexiness to that. You know, I got to like study and really understand the habits and buying patterns and risk profiles of rich people. And it's interesting. It's super, super interesting.
Yeah, I think we should send this out to the listeners right now, which is, you know, we're talking with Julie, who helps empower creative entrepreneurs. And we're going to talk about business a lot. I think it's going to pop up a lot in this. And before our conversation, we talked about the idea that like, you know, business is bad. Well, that's not true. Like if we can understand certain elements of business, we can find ways to give ourselves extra resources to empower our creative selves. So just a little like disclaimer for listeners out there who are like, why are we talking about money so much? Like we're going to find that intersection.
Yeah.
Let me just make sure you know it. So the thing I'm interested in, I was unaware that you had that nanny experience in France, which I'm just jealous of the amount of good food you've surrounded yourself with in this career so far, Julie.
But I've had a good food life. I'm very thankful for it. Yeah.
Well, we talk about food on the show a lot, so it fits in perfectly. But you ended up working for a company called Chubb and started in Boston, if I understand, and then ended up working in London. And I'm curious about that experience of kind of seeing the workplace from a US perspective and then seeing it from this sort of like global perspective. Like what was that like being able to sort of just see these inner workings and these systems that you were fascinated with in a context of different countries?
That's such a great question. You know, here's something I really learned about myself in London that I did not see coming. I realized through and through and through, obviously I'm kind of generalizing here, but I have kernels of truth in it. I am American when it comes to business. I have other friends who have had amazing expat experiences, and I did have a great experience overall. I did not like working and doing business in London. And look, of course, we're talking about a very specific market. Again, insurance, financial services. You know, you might have a picture of a middle, older white guy if you think about that in America. Multiply that by 10 if you go to the London market. Like, that's literally where insurance was invented. And so just being super transparent, for me personally, again, just for me, like, it wasn't, I didn't enjoy working there. I didn't enjoy the way that business was done. You know, like, a lot of business at the time that I was there, at least, was like still done in the pub. Like, that's just not, that's great if you can operate that way. That's not where I do my best work. But then here's the other kind of like theme that is going to sound like I'm being tongue in cheek, but it was very, I mean, the effects of it were very, very true. I would kind of joke that, you know, if you were to ask why something is done a certain way in London, I guess in the London insurance market, at least, like, the answer would be, well, because that's the way we've always done it. And so, like, if you're a visitor to London, that's what makes that city so beautiful. Like, oh my God, the history and the origins and the, I mean, just like the depth of longevity of things there. But like, if you're someone who does kind of have an entrepreneurial spirit, or like you do question why things are the way things are, like, that is, ugh, like, it's just so stifling. And then I guess I'll just add this as well. Like, the other thing I did while I was in London was I got my executive MBA in Paris. So I mean, I didn't work in Paris, but I worked with, you know, my colleagues from a university standpoint in Paris. And yeah, just kind of same thing, even more of a degree. So again, like, what I really learned about Europe, wonderful experience, love to absorb their culture. And I still have friends, a lot of friends over there, et cetera. But for me personally, from a working and kind of just how I see business and the world point of view, I'm an American and I'm so thankful for that.
That's really interesting, especially in a time like in American culture where, like, fear is what makes most people make decisions, right? And I think that, like, in American culture right now, like, so many of us, maybe this is me just projecting, but like, have an inherent like enjoyment and like pride in the easily accessibility of resources. But on the flip side, knowing that every single thing I do is benefiting somebody in an office somewhere, where like those systems have kind of like harmed our culture. It's really interesting just to hear that, like, you know, the sort of, like, to hear somebody say, like, I'm an American business person is just a really interesting, unique, like, statement.
A controversial kind of stark thing to say, right?
But it sounds like you're coming at it from a, you know, you felt like you were in a lockbox in London. Like, this is the way things work. What's right. The point of innovating a system? And you're like, no, the whole point of being an American business person is to innovate these systems.
Right. Right. And if, I mean, this is like getting pretty philosophical, but again, I think there's kind of a red line of truth where, like, if you think about, like, why did people come over to America from Europe in the first place, right? Like, it was to escape and do things differently. And I, you know, I have, of course, like, history stuff withstanding, like, I have a perspective on that that's kind of like, oh, I get the parallels.
Yeah, it's the 2000s version of that, right?
Right.
One of the things I'm glad you brought up it was HEC Paris is where you got your executive MBA.
Correct.
One of the things I'm curious about is it was fun to research that program a little bit, mainly because I had never just heard of the term executive MBA. And it seems like a fascinating process. So like for people who are listening, who's like, okay, I know Masters of Business Administration. What is the difference between an MBA and executive MBA?
I think, and I don't say this in like with a negative kind of way at all, but like, I think I would just say the core difference is the maturity of the people in the program. So when I did it, I found out after the fact, I was the youngest person they had admitted to the program. So, I mean, for that one specifically, like we didn't have to take the GMATs, for example, but of course we had to do like a major submission. And then once we got through a couple of gates, we had to go to Paris and like we were given a case study and had to present to a board and like do kind of like live stuff showing our business acumen and how we think about things, et cetera. So I'm not going to get this totally, totally right, but it was something like, I think the average age was like late 40s, early 50s. So like the medium of like the participants had a really solid few decades of work experience under their belt. Most of them were like upper mid management to executive management. And so, yeah, I would just kind of say like the gravity of the experience, you know, the material may or may not be different from what is taught in an MBA, but just like the way it is worked from the other people in the room, right? Like it's all about kind of the quality of people you're around.
Yeah, it was really interesting researching it because it sounds like the executive MBA is kind of geared toward people who have like 10 to 15 years of experience kind of under their belt. And it's typically like the full-time employment educational balance where like you're doing nights and weekends.
Yes, that's right. Yep.
As opposed to traditional MBA, which is, you know, full-time classes, kind of streamlining you and ensuring that you're immersed in as much of the environment as you can be 24/7, whereas the executive MBA is for people who know, like, I've already had that immersion. Now I'm doing something different. But the thing that I was curious about for that program is that it seems like it's inherently entrepreneurial minded. Like, they very much pride themselves on the number of people who graduate from the HEC Paris executive MBA program and then start their own businesses. And I was curious about, like, what about that sort of entrepreneurial calling, like, meshed with your educational goals?
You know, so my motivation for doing that was not with a very specific goal in mind. I think very similar to you, Ryan. I'm someone who just like inherently loves learning. So like, I was just always going to get my MBA and I was always going to go to school in Paris somehow, some way. Like those were two things that I was just like going to do because I wanted to do them. So I want to be really clear. Like I didn't go in with the goal of like, okay, this is like where I'm going to end up. You know, what I've found for myself, and I'll circle kind of back hopefully to distinctly answer your question, but what I found for myself was like that time. So speaking to the logistics you were describing, the way I did that program was, I think we were like 8 days in Paris every 8 weeks or something like that. So I would have like these isolated bubbles of immersion before going back to my normal work life. And I found that time a way to just kind of be like the freeing time to really imagine what could be, right? And so I didn't go in with the intention of leaving Chubb. I didn't go in with the intention of starting my own business, but I think kind of softly the pieces that came together for me were, you know, I think one of my superpowers is kind of learning theoretical information and thinking about how to apply it in really specific and totally different ways. And so, you know, my experience at work, as well as some of these theories I was learning, and then, you know, I'm just kind of like a spiritual learner and some other gushy stuff on the side too. Like, I don't know, that kind of all those things together gave me this laboratory to really think about like, what else could it be?
That's awesome. And I like the idea of, I heard a really interesting analogy about like creative writing, about how like you go down, if it's like scuba diving and you go down in the depths, and then while you're down there, you can't just come back to the surface. You have to take your sweet time and you have to make sure that the nitrogen leaves your blood, and you have to kind of take your time to get down and get into that headspace, and then come back up slowly and then reacclimate to the world, and then say, all right, I need to prepare for the next day of writing and make your way down. It's interesting that that program had that sort of like 8-week cycle where it's like, you make your way into the depths of this business world, and then you come back, you live your life, and you have all this stuff that you're kind of processing in the background as you make your way.
Yeah, that's a really beautiful way to say it. Yeah, I agree.
Awesome. So enough about your education. Let's talk about the cool stuff that you're doing now. So you, you know, it sounds like when you were finishing your executive MBA and kind of wrapping up your career, realizing, you know what, I think I want to make it back to the US. You settle into East Nashville and decide to start Elevated Outcomes, which is your awesome company that is, you know, empowering creatives to make sure that they can find sustainability to their businesses. What was like the linchpin, or what was the moment at which you decided, you know what, like this sort of consulting, this sort of like third party perspective is the place that I want to spend most of my time?
You know, I think I would say it this way. There wasn't a moment or a flash of light. I mean, look, there were like life things kind of coming together and presenting opportunities. So as you pointed out, I had spent 3 years in London to the day. It was time to repatriate. We were coming back to the US. I was wrapping up the executive MBA. My husband and I had decided to move to Nashville, which for all intents and purposes was kind of like random. There wasn't a specific thing pulling us here. I had set myself up financially so that I could kind of make a change. We didn't have a family aside from the two of us. And so, you know, kind of philosophically in my life, it was just like, look, if I'm ever going to think about doing something like this, there is literally not going to be a cleaner opening ever. Like if I don't do this now, I'm never going to do it. Like it's all being served up. Like the opening is just being presented to me. So, you know, I think that that kind of side of things is important, but then specifically with the business itself. So the job, just to back up one quick second, kind of the job that took me over to London was, you know, my life-changing kind of career turn was when I got an opportunity to work on the global strategy and operations team that was international. I mean, that changed everything for me. And I had, God, bosses and executives who taught me most of the things I know today. And I'm so thankful for it. I loved that work. There was nothing technical about kind of like work that I wanted to change. I loved that work. So like, basically, I mean, we kind of describe ourselves as an outsourced strategy department for small creative businesses. So like that is the work that we do to this day. I'll say this in kind of a silly way, but like, I was just like, what would it be like to do that work with people I really like and connect with on a human level? And to boot, I like pretty things. Like I like design. I like art. I like, you know, high-end services. Like, oh my gosh. And if we could do that with people where I love being like a customer of their products and I'm just like super, super passionate about the products, like, and we could choose the clients we want to work with, et cetera. Like that's the dream. So, you know, it's the practical of that kind of life path stuff. And then like, yeah, this is the work. Nothing's changing about that. Is there a need in a target market that I personally find really interesting to create a business opportunity? And luckily, the answer was yes.
How familiar were you? Well, I'm going to ask this question, I might have to do some clarification, but like, how familiar were you with the culture of Nashville and the culture of East Nashville while you were coming up with this idea?
Such a great question. Not super familiar. I had been to Nashville I'd been to Nashville three times, a total of three times before. And You know, so as with anything, like part of it was smarts and part of it was just kind of gut and hearts, right? So one of the reasons my husband Dave and I chose Nashville, there were three cities we were debating among. And, you know, I kind of did an anecdotal evaluation of the three of them. And I ultimately said to him, I was like, look, all these cities actually kind of feel similar and have some commonalities to me. I think Nashville still has more runway in front of it than the other two. I think the other two are close to peaking and Nashville still has room to grow. I did not know how accurate that statement was. It actually had more room to grow than I thought was true, but like that was kind of like the entry. So I say that to say, I mean, look, the growth of Nashville has been a big part of our success as well. And then also on top of that, kind of like the stage of Nashville where it is a place where there's certainly money here, there's sophisticated stuff happening, but it still has this kind of undercurrent of approachability, both in just like the way people relate to each other and how business is done, as well as there is room for a creative market that can make money here. You know, I think I had done, like, I don't want to give myself too much credit, a cursory evaluation that kind of like said, like, I think this could be true. But it has exceeded my expectations in that way. So it's been iterative, I would say, over the past 6 years.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that, like, you know, we're both middle-aged or nearing middle-aged, depending on how you want to, you know, discuss it. And I think that's like, you know, one of the things I wasn't anticipating as I sort of like grew up and looked at my own career is like, you know, the being able to grow with the city that you're in is a lot of what has to, like, what resource you need in order to make sure that there's growth potential for you, you know. And if you're somebody who wants to get in and do the same job for 30 years, like, God bless you. I wish you the best of luck. That I wish I could find, you know, like, but it's just a thing where, like, identifying a place based off of what will this look like in 10 or 20 years isn't the thing that an 18 or a 25 year old does when they step right into, you know, a place. Whereas when you're in your 30s, you know, you're in your 40s, you're like, okay, like, when I'm nearing retirement, is this a place where I'll be able to afford? Is this a place where there's going to be cool stuff? And like looking at things through those rose colored glasses of like, this is what the future is of the city is like something that we don't think about a lot.
Yeah. God, I just think that's so beautifully and articulately said. And I think, you know, a personal characteristic of mine that is a strength and a liability, as any characteristic is I feel like I have X-ray vision to see the potential of things, places, people. Sometimes that's not like the liability side of things, is like, you have to be here now. So like sometimes that gets me in trouble. But gosh, the way you say like the potential, I totally, totally agree with you. And like, you know, as I think, I mean, we're a virtual business. We work with clients all over the country, but certainly like the bulk of our clients are in Nashville. And as I think about kind of more physical geographic expansion, what I would call like secondary markets, is the way I think about that. Like, what are the other cities like the Nashville 6-10 years ago that have that like upward curve to still go?
Yeah. And I, for anybody who, like, as we're talking, I've been to Nashville twice and East Nashville twice. So like, I have a limited purview, but the thing that I really like about East Nashville is that, like, every time I'm there and I walk around it, public art is valued.
Yes.
You know, like, one of the places we discovered was this place called the Grilled Cheesery, which is like, sure, a, you know, Michelin star chef is like, I want to create a business that makes grilled cheese, and they do it. And they had a milkshake that will stay with me forever.
Okay.
But the thing that I just think is really important about that too, is that as you think about where you reside and what this place will look like in the future, if you live in a place that's I don't know, you don't find that inspiring, even if you are a global company that is helping to inspire creatives, you can't walk around your own neighborhood and find inspiration. Like, you can't feed that into the people you're working with. So I just think it's really interesting that you ended up in a place where just like creativity and self-expression and chicken sledding and whatever is like highly appreciated. Yeah. I think that probably feeds you and your company in ways that you can't be quantified.
Absolutely. And like, this is kind of a different riff on that. That's a little more kind of businessy minded. I think your philosophy totally, totally stays true. But if I, so one of the kind of categories of businesses we work with are designers and fabricators. So a lot of interior designers, and then people who might be like making the things that interior designers or architects are using. So I think of a company, Southern Lights Electric, that does these really beautiful light fixtures, New Hat, that does all these creative custom surface coverings. I mean, you know, we can go out to a good number of restaurants or hotels or locations in Nashville and be able to say like, oh my gosh, that's New Hat's wallpaper. That's a Southern Lights Electric light fixture. And so like, to your point, there's like personal inspiration in that. And then like, let me be really frank, there's like business credibility to that too, because they're doing incredible, incredible work. And then like, I would also say like, not only the people, but the smart businesses who have entered into Nashville, especially those from the outside, have understood what a special market it is in that way, that does really honor and value the local creators. And so the smart businesses and the people with money are hiring those people because they know that is a value in the Nashville market.
That's awesome. So you, I'm curious about your first year with Elevated Outcomes. Okay. You know, like, so I appreciate your transparency, and I had a cushion, right? Like, you had some money to rely on, you had the ability to kind of push forward. How did the model come together? You created the Elevated Outcomes framework that you sort of utilize, which is basically like, a bunch of different ideas and procedures that you're going to help implement with different businesses. How did that all come together? And what was that sort of first year of growth like?
The first year of growth, I mean, I guess the good news, if you will, is, like I said, kind of like the technical work that we do is the work I've been doing now for the past 10, 15 years, whatever it is. So I guess I had the like weird advantage of like, I was just coming in, like using my skills and doing things that were second nature. And actually, like, I mean, let's go back to the insurance piece, right? My very first job out of college was this high net worth property and casualty underwriter. So like, I have learned everything I need to know about products and pricing, which is like the foundational layer of our framework, from insurance. Like, there's not, I learned how to build actuarial models and like break down pricing and build it back up and assess risk of this like invisible product, essentially, right? Like, it's not like a cost of goods sold at a markup. Like, you're figuring out how to sell this somewhat invisible service. And so actually, I would say like the work that I really, really focused on the first year, and that I just kind of like learned by doing it, like, oh my God, this is what every creative, and not creatives too, but like, this is what every creative needs, is products and pricing work. And like, it doesn't sound sexy, but it is the thing that makes all the difference in the world. I mean, I'll share this like super specific thing about our own business. We were talking about kind of Elevated Outcomes results from last year before we hopped on the call. We hit 44% of our new business goal, but we ended up hitting 80% of our financial goal. And that's because there was this kind of like invisible behind the scenes product and pricing work happening in the background. Like, it is, it's the foundation layer that makes everything better or worse. And it's just so, so, so important for creatives, particularly who often have a lot of internal confusion about like my personal worth and value versus the worth and value of the thing that I make and sell.
Yeah. And I think, what did I put here? One of the like guidelines that you strive for is to make things automated and unemotional.
Yes. 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 And being one of the phrases we use a lot is facts and feelings, right? I'm generalizing, but I think a lot of creatives would say like, I operate on emotion, or I operate on feeling. And like, we never want to strip that away from someone. We always say like, no, like your feelings are part of it. Like you have your own business for a reason. And I want to evaluate things in black and white and put the numbers in front of you. And I want you to be able to see the facts too. I want to make a decision and bring your facts and your feelings together.
Yeah. Like one of the things I appreciate about you is that like you and I are both systems people. And mm-hmm. I think that oftentimes like that really scares people because they're like, well, what if I want to do this thing that won't totally. Fit with this model? And if you can get to a point where you make space for the spontaneous and you make space for the, I guess I'll just call it like maintenance driven components. Like you got to pay your taxes. You have to do accounting. You have to figure these things out. If you can automate that and make that unemotional, forget to stick with your quote, you have so much more space, so much more headspace to be able to grow those parts of your business.
Bingo. I mean, you just made the sales pitch perfectly. And I will say too, I mean, literally what you said word for word is an objection I used to get from a lot of people in years 1, 2, and 3. And I think we just kind of have enough like proof points and referrals from current clients coming in where like people, I mean, I guess I'm actually like proud of this. If I kind of step back and think of it, like creatives are now coming to us expressing the desire for the structure and the systems, which was absolutely not true in year one. And so for whatever reason, I'm so thankful that the way you're describing it, I think is starting to be embraced by creatives as well.
Well, how did you find those collaborators? How did you find those creatives in your first couple years in business? Because it's you know, it's not easy to start a new thing and say, I've got all this experience. I'm going to apply it this other place. Now, trust me, I'm going to help your business grow. Like, how did you find those people?
Okay. So I want to kind of make 2 points with this. One is, again, I had a very lucky career. So one of the kind of chapters of my career was literally, I think my title was business development manager. So my job was to move to Boston and to do exactly what you said for a company, right? And to like open this new territory and find the partners and start selling the thing. So I just had experience in like moving to new markets and doing that. But like, how do you do that, right? Is I could think what you're really asking. And I think like one of the points I want to make is, again, this is something like we work with our clients a lot on, is I like to kind of joke, just because you build it doesn't mean they'll come. And I think there is an unwritten, or maybe it is a written script for creatives of like, if my thing is good enough, everyone is just going to want it. And that's just not true. Like you still have to sell, like everyone needs to be a salesperson at the end of the day. And like, you know, one of the things we are really trying to do philosophically in our brand is like rewrite or reposition or rebrand what being a quote salesperson means. Like it does not mean like being some like icky person or selling people what they don't need or being disingenuous to yourself. Like we really talk about, again, relational business development. And there is a system to do that, surprise, surprise. And there is a way to do it in a way that is completely authentic to you as a human being. It's a win-win situation for the person you're trying to sell it to, et cetera. So like the way I did that and built up that clientele was, relational business development and pounding the pavement and like working through the rejection and just doing it consistently. But the second point I want to make about that too is, you know, the way I did go through the process of like building a business plan and all that kind of stuff. And so as part of my market research for that plan, I contacted people I both knew and didn't know. And I just asked them like, if I could chat with them and have conversations and really like understand what the pain points and problems were. And what happened, so before I even like formally launched Elevated Outcomes, as I was just having those conversations with people, you know, we would talk for 60 or 90 minutes and those conversations would conclude and they would say like, yeah, I don't care if your like website isn't launched yet. Like, are you ready to take on clients? Like, I can tell you know what you're talking about. And so like the point I kind of want to make with that is like, you just start doing it and demonstrating what you know and what you can do, and like do it generously and do it freely, and don't try to like hoard resources that you have. Like, you have to be bold with being proactive and building relationships with people, and then just start doing it. And if there is actually a business opportunity and market for them, they're going to be eager to pay you for it, as a matter of fact. So I just like started doing instead of procrastinating planning.
Is that trademark too? Procrastinate planning?
That's not actually, I take that from someone else. So I want to make sure, I think that's Denise Duffield Thomas's. So I want to make sure I give her appropriate credit. Procrastinate plan is not my thing, but yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. Whenever I've interviewed like creative writers or whatever, they, you know, like one of the comments, this comic book writer I interviewed, he's like, you can procrastinate with research as long as you want, but at some point you have to write. And I think that in any of these creative pursuits, you know, even if it's just doing the laundry, like at some point you just got to start doing it, and then the rest of the resources will find themselves there.
Yeah.
One of the things that I'm curious about for your business, I have so many things I'm curious about for your business, but the one I want to focus on is the in-house component, which is, you know, like you've done such a great job in this conversation of demonstrating the way in which like there's been a really nice linear point to you, like linear line for you to get to this point where like, you know, I studied this type of marketing. I learned that I didn't want to do food. I wanted to work for a big corporation. I learned all these systems within it. I knew I was good at it. I was entrusted in these places. And then I was able to apply it to something that was a little bit more me. How about on the flip side, where you need to grow your team and you need to make sure that your team is full of people that have the skill sets that you need? Like, how have you identified those people to join your business?
My gosh. I mean, this is still and will always be for me and for everybody a work in progress. And I've, as you, I probably are guessing and maybe poking at a little bit, and I'm happy to share, you know, I've made really good decisions and I made mistakes along the way, and I still have some pieces of it I'm trying to figure out. I think like, here's kind of one high level thing I want to make sure to share, because it's one of the things that we help clients with, because it's critical in a creative and or a service-based business. So it's not just the technical skill set, it is the delivery of it, right? And when, you know, though the business has never been called the Julie Sellers, whatever, obviously I was doing it alone at first. And so part of what people were buying was not just the technical results, but the experience and the how it was delivered. And so one of the things I've been really conscious of from the beginning, but it's a push-pull, right? And it's a constant like recalibration, is, okay, I need to find people who can do these pretty sophisticated technical things, and they deliver the brand and the experience in a way similar to how I would. And so look, here's the challenge with that. And like, I mean, that's a challenge in itself, but kind of like a philosophical and ethical thing I am always, always asking myself and really trying to hold myself and others to the fire with is like, okay, how do you find and build a team who can do the technical thing, who can do it similarly in a way to how you would deliver it personality wise, and so that you're not building a club of lookalike people and you're creating paths and openness for diversity and inclusion. I mean, that like, this is big, big picture question, but it's something I'm like challenging myself and our team on all the time. Like, how can you achieve all three of those things? And so look, I don't have that answer buttoned up at 100% yet. And I don't know that I ever will. And hopefully I'll remain open to continue challenging myself and others on that initiative. But I think, you know, I think acknowledging, again, especially for service-based businesses, the technical what has to be no greater than the how someone is delivering it to. And so figuring out ways to find and vet for and people who have the openness and the egolessness to like tweak their approach so that it does align with the company branding. So I'm sorry, that's not like the cleanest answer, because the truth is like, it's a work in progress and it's really hard.
Yeah. I mean, the case study that I always think of is, the company WordPress, who like their infrastructure powers, my stats are probably wrong, but at the time it was like something like 75 or 80% of all websites on the web. Right. So like all these websites, they make their money by working with large companies and handling their web presence, whether it's Best Buy or Forbes or whomever. And whenever the president of the company is interviewed, it's always like, what do you do? He's like, I spend 85% of my time searching for talent, you know, like, and the entire company is like 40 or 60 people. It's a very small company, but making sure that you don't just hire somebody to work for the right now, but somebody who is going to be able to be mission focused and all that is really, really difficult.
It's really difficult. And I don't know if you want to use this as a segue or not, but like, my God, talk about the long game. And like, and in contrast to that, typical employee tenure at places now, generations obviously have stuff to do with that, quick hits and life stage as well. I feel like that's something I've learned a lot about over the past couple of years, is really being thoughtful about someone's career stage and life stage as part of the mix and considering that too. It's hard work, and it does take hiring for the long game and learned the hard way, holding the mirror up, right? Like, not everyone is going to get on board with the long game, and you can't control that, those decisions, or change people's minds about that necessarily.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to get to the long game question. I have one other quick just interjection though, which is, you could have helped anybody in business, right? You decided to go the creative route. You could have just focused on people who own auto shops, you know, like you could have focused on anybody. And please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the main focus of your business is focusing on people in the design, wellness, and then professional services, kind of high-end hospitality. What made you decide to focus on those sort of pillars? Because it's I can see where they interconnect, but it's a really interesting, it's not like anybody who works in the arts is going to come to you. It's even more niche than that. And I'm curious about that sort of design, wellness, professional services. What about those three really spoke to you?
So I think that's actually, you created the most beautiful segue for it, which is, I mean, again, just kind of from selfish personal reasons, I'm like, I'm customers of those businesses. Like, I love them and I want them to do well, and they make pretty things and they make my life better. So like, great, everybody wins. But then, I mean, from a more like business lens point of view, my answer is, you know, those businesses, like, one may look at them and think like, yeah, I see similarities, or I don't see any similarity at all. The key kind of connective thread among all of them is that thing we were just talking about, which is like, maybe I have a physical product to sell, or maybe I don't, maybe it is a service, but the experience matters. It's not just a widget. This is not going to be a business built on scale. Like, the experience and how I deliver it, and as a, you know, as an owner, being able to scale myself, kind of in quotation marks, but replicate the client or customer experience, is actually the thing that, as my colleague Aaron would say, like, drives up the value stick that makes not only the business sustainable beyond the owner, but that makes the business financially viable, because people will pay a premium to it. So yeah, I mean, the connective thread among those businesses, like, the experience is the driver of the differentiator of the business.
And if I understand that correctly, you're saying that, like, so those three, I guess, business types, have clientele that you can identify, that have resources that they are willing to spend in those fields. Is that a fair assessment?
That's a very fair assessment. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. And I think that's important too, because it safeguards your own business, because we're about to talk about long game. But in regards to making sure that you're working with businesses where you have a knowledge base of that clientele and you're able to sort of lead a horse to water to be able to find those.
Yes. Yeah.
Cool. So let's talk about that idea of, short game versus long game. So listeners, if you're hearing us say that a lot, it's because prior to this conversation started, we talked about the idea that, in today's culture, we have a very instant gratification culture. And that's, I would argue, has always existed in different ways. But now we have different sort of elements where oftentimes we reward ourselves and forget we rewarded ourselves. And then we can't remember why we got that resource to help get us to the next place, or we forget about it, whatever. But it's getting harder and harder to find people who Julie quoted as saying before the interview are long game people, people that are looking, not necessarily in this sort of like crisis. I need to make sure that I can figure things out today, tomorrow, next month, but also, hey, this is a business that I want to do and I want it to succeed for 10 years, 20 years. I want to be long dead and this thing keeps going. Like, how, I guess my question is, like, as you're working with clients, like, how does instilling that sort of long game, long-term mentality work? Like, how do you teach someone to take a step back and say, we're not worried about just the month of March. We're worried about 2024, 2027, 2037, and kind of move from there.
So my gut reaction to your question is, and then I'll kind of get more specific, but I just have like a really like guttural reaction of, I actually think you can't teach people that. Again, like learned the hard way, holding up the mirror. And when I answer this question, I'm thinking about both like clients and I'm thinking like internally too, right? Like, I don't know that you can teach someone that, or like maybe better said, like, I don't come in trying to anymore. This is like a new skill I'm working on for myself, but like no longer am I trying to change people's mind about that. Look, if you're like an instant quick hit person, you're probably going to be that way. Unless, so then my more kind of like specific answer to your question is, I have seen people start to open up their minds to those possibilities, both, going back to that kind of idea of facts and feelings, right? So we do get like really, really specific about like looking at numbers with people over a span of time, like making them see the black and white to mirror with their most recent feelings to help with recency bias, both for good and for bad. So I think the facts and feelings perspective, and then of course all the work that goes into the data collection for that is one piece of it. I think the other piece of it is storytelling and like example setting and example telling. Like, I'm thinking about, one of my colleague employees who was asking me about this a couple months ago, and she was asking me like, oh my God, like, how did you get so wired for the long game? And I was just sharing like, it wasn't an intentional thing I set out to do, and I do think I have some wiring to that naturally, but like just like specific examples of things that have happened in my life and my business and businesses I've worked for were just like, yeah. And then this is how it turned out in the end. And like, oh my God, that ending was so much better than if like the quick thing had happened. And so like, I don't think you can force the teaching. I think, I think you can, like, if someone is interested, you can serve up the information, but like, it really is like, oh God, like helping them walk through it so that they build up their own set of experiences and then finally start to believe it. But like, again, learned the hard way. Like, you can't force it on other people, and it's not going to be for everyone. It's just not. And this is a bit of a turn, but still on the topic, if you don't mind, we just made a hire, that is someone I have been wanting to hire for over 2 years. And she and I started the conversation, I mean, literally 2 years ago on social media. The other day, I shared our LinkedIn DMs of when we were first organizing getting dinner together. And I asked her to join us, 2 years ago, and X, Y, and Z. The answer was no. And I also didn't have this kind of like goal of like, I'm going to win her one day. Like I wasn't kind of coming in that heavy handed or with that like objective in mind. But it was also, again, back to kind of relational business development. I mean, obviously I thought highly of her, et cetera. I was just like, all right, let's stay in touch. Like, and we did just stay in touch. Like we'll go on walks together, blah, blah, blah. We've like built a relationship over 2 years. And then God, I think it was like August or September. I said to her, and this was just kind of like total gut, not a specific thing in mind. I said to her, I don't have an opening right now, but as you can guess, I'm thinking forward to next year. And I know you rejected me a couple of years ago, but like, if you would ever be interested, I just want to like say like the door would be open for my end. And I think this could be so cool. And do you mind just kind of like considering that? And I said to her, like, hold it in your palm very lightly. And she was like, okay, I'll hold it in my palm lightly. And then a month or two later, I had an opening and I called her and I said, could you like grasp that thing in your palm a little more heavily? And so I'm sorry for that like kind of segue story, but she and I have been talking so much about like the journey to kind of building that relationship and like not now, I guess just kind of summarizing with quick wins, long game, like not now doesn't mean not forever. And so there is a bit of like mushiness and trust of like, look, my approach to life is like, I want to control everything I can control. And then like, I let go because what else are you going to do? And then I trust like the right thing is going to happen. And, I think the adage is right. Like good things take time. And that's not how our culture is wired right now, of course. And that goes for, sorry, last thing I'll say about this too. Like that goes for like clientele and customers as well. Like we find in our sales cycle with prospects, like our prospects work one of two ways. They either sign like right away because they're like, I need you yesterday, or we nurture that relationship for 18 months to 2 years. It's right away or 18 months to 2 years. Like it's a long game we're building.
Well, it's also interesting just in the sense that like that's something that you have to consciously structure into your business model.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And the discipline to do it, like the process works, but you have to work the process.
Yeah. So I have two questions for you. I really appreciate your time, Julie. And I want to switch gears a little bit, which is I want to talk about role modeling a little bit. Because I think that like, one of the things about sort of coaching businesses or, it's coaching businesses is coaching people. And, you have to make sure that you're demonstrating that you could also do it and that, you have the capability of being successful. And one of the things that you've been pretty outspoken on, you've written about it, you've been interviewed on it, is your approach to personal finance. And I was curious if we could just kind of touch on that a little bit, because I think it's important. I read the book, The Millionaire Next Door, a number of years ago, which is just such a fun read. And, one of the things that if you have money and if people know you have money, you get called by financial advisors all the time. Mm. And one of the people interviewed in the book says like, sure, like you send me over your portfolio and how your own personal finances are doing, and then I'll sign on with you. And the person claims that they've never gotten anybody to follow through on that. But you, on the other hand, have no problem talking about, this is the way in which I handle my own personal finance. And I'm curious about like how you approach that just for you. Like, how do you ensure that you're thinking about your own money in that sort of automated and unemotional kind of way?
I'm going to requote someone who was quoting someone else, but I always like to give credit where credit is due. She said to me a couple months ago that she had heard someone say like, people who actually make money like talking about money or like it can be specific in talking about money. And I just thought, and I think you're kind of like saying that in a different way. And I just thought that was like a brilliant, really kind of true thing. I mean, look, as I kind of touched on before, for whatever nurture and nature reasons, from a very, very young age, I recognized money is power. And so I have been making my own money since my t-shirt business at daycare in second grade, like in any kind of scrappy way, right? Especially as a woman and a creative, for creatives, like, I just think that's so important. Money is power and money is good, right? Like money, or I should say money is neutral. And then like you apply to it whatever emotion you want to apply to it. And so, I mean, and I'm happy to kind of answer any follow-up questions, but if I just think about one of the things that I think is so, so important in the intersection of personal finances and small business finances is, I will make this statement, your profit is not the money you pay yourself as an owner, especially if you're a solopreneur. So most solopreneurs think about their profit in quotation marks as like, this is the money I take home. And to the point you keep driving home that I'm so thankful of over and over is like, it should be systematized, right? Like you should be taking an owner's draw from your salary that is automated and consistent as if you were working for someone else's business. And then you can structure ways to like give yourself raises, et cetera, et cetera. For my, so that's kind of like a philosophy or a framework and a really bold statement that might ruffle some feathers, because I know that's not the way it happens for most people and businesses, but like you should have an automated owner salary that is an extraction from your business, but not intertwined with your business. For me personally, you know, I have always known I was gonna, to your point about role modeling, right? Build this business in a sustainable way beyond me. Like solopreneurship was never in the cards for me, because how am I gonna teach other people to do something I'm not doing, right? I agree with you entirely. And so, you know, from day one of like actually making money and having enough to pay myself a salary, I have always contained that in a way so that I could reinvest in the business, and specifically mostly like reinvest in people and bring people into the business. And so I just think it's a really important thing for people to think about if you do want to grow. And that doesn't have to mean growing with people. It can be growing with other resources. But if you want to grow in a way that is making the business sustainable beyond you trading your time or talents for money, you have to be thinking about the separation of the business's money and your personal money so that you can reinvest in those resources.
Yeah. And like one of the things that, you know, just reading your Business Insider article is that like, you're a huge proponent of having separate bank accounts that have separate components to them. So, you know,
jobs,
one is,
yeah.
Like, and I think as you're talking about the idea of like, you need to pay yourself a salary no matter what your profits are. And I just, you know, thinking in that mentality of just, even if you're somebody who has a day job and you know you make X amount per week, if you put 5% of that in a separate account, that's your, this is my growth. And then, you know, 70% in another account, which is like, this is what I'm being paid. And you have another one that's just for incidentals there, you know, that ability to separate money helps build that unemotional attachment to it.
Totally. Totally. And I would say, gosh, at some times I like regret kind of bringing my husband into this. I mean, you're alluding to, I think if I'm remembering right, Business Insider did an article on like how I manage my personal finances. That same philosophy as you're saying, like, we have like our personal finances set up in this way where, this isn't his original words, but like my husband Dave likes to say, all of our money has a job, right? So like the job might be investing in our future self. The job might be maintaining our house. The job might be like, I like eating well. We spend a lot of money at restaurants. Like there are fun jobs too. And so I kind of created a monster out of him. Like he's like really, really into every single dollar that we have has a job now. And it's just another one of those things where structure creates freedom. If you don't mind, hopefully this is helpful. I'll give two resources. These aren't new, but I think, I mean, they are my go-to on these topics. So when it comes to this kind of structure that we're talking about for Personal Finances, Ramit Sethi's I Will Teach You to Be Rich is kind of like a system that I think very highly of. And then on the business side of things, and especially if someone has questions like, well, how much should I be paying myself? How much should I be reinvesting? What should profits be? Profit First is my go-to resource on this. And I would say every creative we have introduced this to, there might be some reluctance at first. And then once they're in, like, holy moly, they are in it and they love it and they can't imagine life without it. So I highly recommend Profit First if this is appealing to people.
Awesome. And you actually reference it in that Business Insider article too, which is fun.
Always give credit to your sources. Yeah.
Absolutely. And then the other question about role modeling too is I'm just curious about your work-life balance. And like just in the sense that, you know, we're in a time where like the term self-care is like being thrown around like a baseball. And everybody's focused on, you know, okay, making sure that you take care of yourself and blah, blah, blah. And once again, that tends to be a short-term thought process. Like, I'm taking myself out to dinner tonight. I'm taking the weekend off. I'm going to plan a vacation next year. Isn't necessarily something that people think about as like that sort of like self-care mentality. But I'm curious about for you, like sustainability and long-term thinking is just built into your being. When it comes to sort of that self-care component, knowing when to put the phone down and that you're not going to answer that client email, can you talk a little bit about how you sort of balance that and what you do for yourself in order to make sure that you're refreshed?
My life changed when I realized how important sleep was. And I feel like there is kind of a cultural movement to sleep, though I don't mean that in kind of like the snappy Instagrammy way now. And it, like anything that we're talking about, there are systems in place to like make sure you're set up for success in that regard. My God, sleep changes everything. And I have a former nutritionist, Chris Sandel, to thank for that circa 2014. And I've certainly had my ups and downs, like calibrating and recalibrating on that. But prioritizing sleep and sleeping well is really, really important. I mean, the other thing I'll say is Dave jokes, you know, you can take the girl out of corporate, but you can't take the corporate out of the girl. Like, I like a structure, surprise, surprise. So like, I still sit down at my desk. Like, I use my Outlook. I have my calendar and my day planned out. And I work a pretty like corporate-y in quotation marks work day. I mean, I'm an early riser and I like doing work in the morning. So I might hit my desk by 7:30 or so in the morning, but like, then I'm shutting off at 5 or whatever the time is. I take breaks during the day. I mean, between meetings, I'm like, my neighbors tease me. I'm doing my laps around the neighborhood. I work from home. Again, I don't mean to be like curt about it, but like, I think this is another area where structure creates freedom. I'll give you my top tip that actually is something that's like a tangible, implementable thing that's changed my life is I don't have email on my phone. Which I know rocks the world of most people out there, but it is a game changer in terms of headspace. And if I can, I'll actually read you a quote from a client who gave me this feedback last week that I was just like, oh my God, I have to write this down. This person's name is Courtney Henry. She has a marketing consulting firm called Growth Minded. We convinced her to take email off her phone. Finally, she was someone who suffered from burnout and overworking. And I asked her, like, she was saying how great it was. And I said, like, can you be more specific and give me kind of feedback about what it's done? And here's what she said. She said, the act of checking email is looking for a problem. And when you check your email on your phone, you're looking for a problem, usually at a time when you're not prepared to solve the problem, end quote. But then she was saying like, so then it just kind of creates this mental drag, right? While you're with the kids, while you're cooking dinner, there's just like, oh my God, Courtney, brilliant. Thank you. So that is my top actually doable tip about like a step toward balance and a step toward kind of boundaries.
And what about hobbies? What do you do for fun?
I fancy myself an amateur look for less interior designer. So I'm constantly tweaking with our house, moving furniture, much to Dave's chagrin, doing arts and crafts projects. So I love just kind of doing that and being in my Pinterest boards and scrapbooks and stuff. And then I do a lot of yoga. Those would be my top two things probably.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was looking at the yoga stuff on Instagram. I was like, I feel like that's going to come up. Well, Julie, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Can you, I always want to make space at the end just for anything that maybe we haven't covered. And obviously you and I could talk for a millennia, but is there anything that we haven't sort of touched on or any topics that you want to jump into?
No, not any topics. I mean, I hope this isn't too corny, but I'd love to kind of close with a quote that I think is, I hope kind of a theme that people are feeling as we walk away. But you and I talked a little bit about, like, I think people, again, whether it's a written or unwritten script, have an idea that business is bad or money is bad and business and creativity don't go together. They should be at odds. And I love this Andy Warhol quote where he says, being good in business is the most fascinating kind of art. Making money is art, and working is art, and good business is the best art. So to me, business is absolutely a creative pursuit in its own right. It is a good thing. It can be a good thing. And the best and most creative types of business are making money and doing good things and being great people. And like both of those things can be true. And that's, you know, the mission I hang my hat on.
I love it. Well, thanks so much for sharing that, Julie. And thanks for being on the show. I want to just throw a few things out there before we depart, which is you are a very prolific writer. You do a lot of really cool posts on your site. So if anybody's interested in kind of hearing more of Julie's voice, checking out the Elevated Outcomes website in the advice section, I think is just an invaluable resource.
Thanks, Ryan. That's so generous.
Yeah. What if for people who are interested in learning more about your business and learning more about you, where should they find you?
So Elevated Outcomes, as you say, and I will kind of remind or tell people it's Elevated with two L's, E-L-L-E, elevatedoutcomes.com. The blog is there, like you said. There's a downloadable on the site that is 5 steps to work on your business instead of in your business. That's a nice place for people to start if they like. And then also our Instagram handle is the same, Elevated Outcomes. You know, we're constantly interacting and connecting with people there. So please don't be shy to say hi. And there should be another downloadable in that, in our kind of profile there too, that's specifically for creatives of 3 steps to make more money doing the work you love. If that can be, you know, a helpful kind of boost to somebody, I'd love to offer that.
Cool. Well, Julie, thanks so much for coming.
Ryan, thank you. This was so lovely, and you're such a great conversationalist.
I really hope you enjoyed that conversation with Julie as much as I did. Ever since we had that conversation, the term procrastiplan has been in regular rotation. And I want to thank her for that. It's always nice to chat with somebody who has just spent so much time in a specific space that you're constantly learning new things. And I have a feeling that Julie and I's paths will cross again, perhaps even on this podcast. You never know. If you like what you're hearing, I hope you'll tune in for the next episode because it's one that holds a very special place in my heart. On March 27th, Lawrence Katz will be joining. And if that name doesn't ring a bell, perhaps the name The Muddy Muddy Bosstones will. Lawrence is the guitarist for The Muddy Muddy Bosstones, having played in that band for over 20 years. And just to be blunt, they're my desert island band. They're the band that if I was stuck with all the music from one group for the rest of history that I had to listen to, who would it be? Well, it would be the Muddy Muddy Bosstones. It would be those amazing guitar riffs from Lawrence Katz. So if you are interested in music business, if you're interested in hearing some tales from the road, if you're interested in somebody who's kind of offering his services to the community and saying, hey, I know how to play guitar. I know how to write music. I know how to operate a studio. If there's something you want to learn from me, I'm available. Well, this conversation is for you. So I really hope that you'll tune in on March 27th back to Meditations with Ryan Zlomek for the Lawrence Katz interview. Equally, if you like what you hear, please, 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 write a review of the show on your favorite podcast channel. This show is growing at a rate that is just bringing me great joy, but I think there's still people out there who would love to hear it. So spread the word. And without further ado, don't forget to make space for conversation because you just might learn something.